Welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror. I'm your co-host, Adam Wybray, along with your other co-host, Ren Wednesday. And in this episode, we'll be going over why we started a podcast in the first place, as well as recapping the four podcasts we've delivered so far, just so everyone can catch up to speed at the beginning of 2018. The opening theme music is by Maki Yamazaki, and the end theme by Joe Kelly, with artwork by Letty Wilson. Do enjoy.
So for this episode, I thought we could just do like a kind of mini episode catch up, maybe some general chat as a kind of fill-in one over the Christmas New Year period before we get into a new topic.
Yeah, it's one if you've gorged yourself to bloatation on Christmas food, you can sit back and listen to us casually sum up the podcasts thus far, and have a bit of a chat about children's horror. Hopefully not too much the horrors of the year. This is intended to distract from all of those.
Yeah, this is an escape.
Palliative, yeah.
Because we didn't really... we sort of just launched into it and didn't really do any general... Why are we here? What are we doing? Chat at the beginning. So
that's a good point, actually. Maybe I sort of worked on the assumption that everyone had so many things that scared them as a child. With such a podcast, you know, the necessity spoke for itself.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't know if everyone lives with such memories of childhood horror as we do.
Yeah, it's hard to know how historically specific it is, right? Because sometimes I do think that growing up as a kid in the early 90s was a particularly fertile period for children's horror. That you had these slightly uneasy programmes on kids' TV like The Demon Headmaster, and you had this rise in young adult fiction. But then, you know, the 70s was also known for things like Children of the Stones, etc. More sort of fantasy, but still quite troubling in its own way. And I've recently read The Water Babies, which...
Oh, you read it?
Oh, God, I read it. It's the most horrific thing I've ever read. Like, yeah. It was horrible. Like, literally, every time a child's introduced, they just die. And it's like, oh, don't worry, they aren't really dead. They're like a water baby or flew off somewhere, I don't know. So, you know, we didn't have it as bad as Victorian kids, clearly. We've all got stories about dying chimney sweeps and men with shock hair that cut off your thumbs and all the rest of it.
I was wondering if we might do cautionary tales at some point.
Well, it would allow us to do the Tiger Lily's version of it as well, which
would be nice. Yeah.
So what inspired you? I mean, we sort of, like, often seems to happen when we work on projects together. You know, one of us comes up with an idea and then the other one, and we sort of come together on some kind of shared interest. You sort of suggested doing something about kind of childhood, I don't know.
Yeah, I think I was thinking of things that we've watched together and things that we've talked about.
Things we've developed in jokes over.
Yeah, basically.
I mean, that would have been I know you also suggested doing one on British comedy or 90s comedy, but the problem is obviously that would just be us making Lee and Herring references. We do enough of those already.
So. I know, I think... Yeah. I think we've been quite good at not doing too many Toowoomerundra in jokes.
Yeah, I tried to watch myself.
But yeah. But so, then I did because, as I mentioned, I sort of was kind of inspired to do a podcast after going to talks at Nine Worlds, which happens every year in London. I'd been to a talk at the previous Nine Worlds by Vanessa Thompsett, which was about children's horror. I was so excited to see this on the schedule, and it was like the one thing that I like absolutely wanted to go to. And it was really good. And inevitably I've actually forgotten all of the interesting and insightful comments that she made. But she talked about Coraline and the witches and a few other things, and about childhood fears and how they come through in these films, and super interesting.
I mean, the witches is definitely one that really scared me as a child, and I think it's interesting for me. I don't know how common this is, because say I was diagnosed with OCD really young, like at least 12, maybe earlier, and so sometimes I don't know whether something was typical or, you know, just kind of characteristic of OCD. I'm not sure, but for me, often the things I associated with giving me fear or anxiety, the objects themselves seem to have an almost unholy charge to them. So I remember going around to a friend's house or a family friend's and the witches being on their bookshelf. And I remember, you know, wanting to take it out and put it in a different room. I didn't even want to sleep in the same room as that book. It almost felt like the book itself, you know, had in there, it was like the Necronomicon or something, that had this kind of charged power or aura of evil or danger about it.
Oh yeah, I was very scared of the boiler in the house had a sticker on it that said sacrificial anode. I don't know what that means. I still don't know what that means.
I don't think you want to know what that means.
No, but I thought it was going to kill me.
Oh. So, I mean, if you're comfortable in delving more into this, like, did you imagine it having an inner life? Like, did you think it had some kind of malevolent design on you?
I'm not sure how much I believed it, or if I just made up a story that scared me, and then I was scared of the boiler. But I was scared of its sacrificial intentions, whatever they were.
So did you feel that the boiler itself had the sacrificial intentions, or that the boiler was a means through it, you know, that it was being used in some kind of sacrifice? Like, did you think that the boiler was some part of a ritual?
Or I think that was more what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, that the boiler was some sort of arcane instrument in a sacrificial ritual.
Or like an altar or an altarpiece or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite interesting you say that, because I also used the boiler to induce horror in my siblings in a playful sense. But I used to, when Leon was young in particular, I used to kind of make theme parks around the house. So like the stairs would be a slide. Like sometimes I put a mattress on the stairs, that would be the slide, and then there'd be one room which would be the roller coaster, which would generally be a kind of extreme piggyback ride, lots of twirling round of things. But I remember I used to reserve the bathroom for a kind of interactive, well, not ghost train, but a sort of story experience. So they'd sit on the toilet with the toilet seat down, you know, and basically, they'd either have to close their eyes or probably put a towel over their heads, and then I'd narrate some kind of scary story. And it was meant to be a bit like those games you play at Halloween, where you have to put a blindfold on and then touch things. Like they say, oh, these are the old crone's eyeballs, and then you touch the peeled grapes, for instance. So, you know, I do that with like shower gel and other things that are in the bathroom. But my most effective one was, it was some kind of bizarre Goosebumps inspired time travel narrative. And you ended up seeing like one of your ancestors, and then you saw their decayed corpse or something. But we'd got these masks for Christmas, these sort of plastic masks, which are just sort of animal masks. Like, there were plastic spectacles with, like, a nose piece. And they weren't that scary, except for if you turned them inside out, you just saw saw the fleshy rubber, and then they looked horrible. Like, they were great fun. Turn these inside out. And so I dressed up the boiler in one of my mum's dresses with this inside-out animal mask, and then at the end of the story, I flew open the closet door and whipped the towel off their head, and you know, they were confronted with this terrible monstrosity, this dressed up decayed monkey corpse boiler monster thing, and I remember it made my brother scream, so you know, it must have had you know.
Yeah. So kind of, I guess, like, when you're a kid, you don't so much know exactly what's possible and what's not possible.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's why The Witches scared me. The Witches, it was particularly the opening chapter when the sort of various historic witches are described and the things they do to different children. Like, with Goosebumps, I definitely did read some of the Goosebumps books, but some of them, I remember I got out from the library and never actually dared read them. That just the names and the covers, you know, were enough.
Yeah, me too. I could never bring myself to read Say Cheese or Die. Yeah, because they look too scary.
I think I bailed on that one. I think I started it, but I think the idea was too upsetting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is a particularly... So that's the one, right, with the camera that shows, you know, who's going to die, like the future, right? Like, you get the photo back and you see dead people.
Which is horrifying. and also kind of similar to my recurring childhood nightmare, in a way, which... Yeah. I'm just revealing all my weird childhood fears. Yeah, I had this nightmare about a red pen that drew on people or things and transformed them into other people or things, or transformed them in some horrible way. It was very scary.
So, like, would it, like, kill the people or transform them into monsters? Or
yeah, sort of transform them into monsters.
A particularly vivid nightmare has just come back to me. Guys, it's the closest to a therapy session our podcast has come yet. in which I woke up, and I think it might have been influenced by The Dark is Rising, of which I'd heard a radio adaptation. So there used to be children's radio. I don't know if it was an hour or half hour. I think it was from perhaps 6 to 6:30 on Sundays, which I used to listen to on Radio 4. And there's a Dark is Rising adaptation, and my memory of how the first book begins, and I might be wrong, we might look at it later on in the series. Generally, my issues with sleep were more that, not so much fear of nightmares. I mean, you know, I definitely remember being very worried about, you know, seeing a monster at the end of the bed, that kind of thing. But I was very worried about not being able to wake up again, or even not being able to sleep again. That very much scared me as a kid, this idea. And I think it all stemmed, you know, I was very literal as a child. I take things very literally. So, like, for instance, one thing that my mum said to me, and, you know, bless her, I'm sure it wasn't intentional. She said, if you don't get to sleep, you won't be able to move in the morning. Or she might have said, you won't be able to get up in the morning. But whatever It was. Basically, I took it as meaning that I would be frozen in bed, effectively, that I wouldn't be able to move my limbs, and that if I didn't get sleep, I'd be in this sort of locked in syndrome, essentially. And this for a good year, I think, or quite a long time, terrified me before I dared raise up the topic with my mum. So I'd obviously get very worried about not being able to get to sleep, which in turn would mean I couldn't sleep. So should we have a sort of brief kind of recap of... I try to think of some different categories for us to, you know, just have a look over our last few podcasts since we started. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what would you say is the scariest thing that we've either watched or read?
The Haunting of Eliza Bellcrow.
Yeah, that seems like a clear answer, right?
Yeah, that's... it's really, very... It's going for it on lots of levels.
There is obviously...
Lots of horror.
Yeah, it's rooted in fantastical horror. Yeah, there's a lot of very grimy real-life horror in there too.
Yep.
And I think it's so closely aligned with its characters' perspectives, you really feel the danger they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just some flat-out revolting descriptions.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, if I say scariest moment, then that's probably also going to be from Eliza Bell, right?
The witchkin. I mean, the one that shriveled the beggar into advanced decay in a moment of seconds was just really grim. Jim Lee Potter, master pickpocket at the age of 12, street urchin in the employ of Pete the Knife. He slept, twitching, in his cot in an empty warehouse, along with six other boys his age, who formed the rest of Pete's gang. It wasn't a bad life, stealing other people's purses, keeping a bit and giving the rest to old Pete. Apart from the occupational hazard of being hung, it was really quite rewarding. It was of the hangman's noose that he dreamed now, a gallows standing alone on the Yorkshire moors, the rope swinging steadily. He often dreamed of the noose, but he never remembered, just as he would not remember this one, which was remarkable because of a new element in it. There was a small child standing by the gallows, a little girl wearing a black funeral dress and a black cloak with a hood set halfway back on her head. He could see she was entirely bald. Her eyes were downturned at first, but when they looked up at him, he could see that her irises were red as blood, and her face was as cold as the grave. He awoke as normal that morning, stretched and got up to have breakfast. It was only later that day that the crimson fever began to make itself felt.
Do you think that's the one that would have scared you most as a kid as well?
Well, the one that scared me most as a kid was Rawhead. treading behind you with his extra step. Yeah.
I think everything that we've looked at so far, out of all of them, Return to Oz would have scared me most as a kid.
Mm.
I think now I just sort of enjoy it as a sort of phantasmagoric genre piece, but as a kid, like the rows of screaming heads would have really upset me, I think, and also just that opening sequence.
Mm-hmm. So, Return to Oz is set 6 months after The Wizard of Oz, and we come back to Kansas, and everything is not going very well at all. Obviously, the house got destroyed in the hurricane, and Uncle Henry is in kind of a funk, and he isn't, like, building the new house as fast as he should be, and Aunt Em can't cope with all the farm chores, and Dorothy can't sleep, and she keeps telling people her stories of Oz, and they don't believe her. And, like, even Bellina, the chicken, isn't laying eggs and is being threatened with being cooked up. So it's a fairly bleak setup. And they're unable to work out what to do with Dorothy, and so they take her to a doctor for electric healing.
What you need is a little electric healing. I've written most problematic moment, but I think there's an obvious answer to this one.
Yeah, there's a clear winner of that one. It's the box trolls.
I mean, it is just very transmisogynistic, which, for people who don't know that word, it's sort of the intersection of transphobia and misogyny that is levelled at trans women and trans feminine people. But it just encompasses a lot of these tropes of, yeah, of seeing femininity in a male character as, you know, it's disgusting and whatever. So there's a scene where Eggs tries to show the crowd that Madame Frufru is actually Archibald Snatcher by, like, removing his wig, which is actually, like, a very old transphobic movie trope that's, like, goes back decades.
I don't think you have to read that much into it to have issues, sadly, with it.
Mm-mm. No.
As it goes. Which one would you be most keen to introduce children to? So if you had access to many impressionable minds.
I do want to say Return to Arthur, though. That seems slightly cruel. maybe the Oz books. Yeah, but...
Yeah, the Oz books were a lot more charming than I expected.
I think if they could handle Return to Oz, I think that would be the one.
I think the Demon Headmaster would make them healthily suspicious of institutional power.
Yes. Yep.
It's not, certainly not in the first book, very fantastical, and though the headmaster seems to have demonic aspects, it's never clearly established, you know, whether he's an alien or human or a demon, you know, quite what he is. But his actual power of hypnosis is one clearly rooted in reality, and in fact, a lot of the means at his disposal as headmaster in the first book and first three episodes of the TV series are ones that an actual cruel or abusive headmaster would have. That the children get told off, and of course when they go home to tell Dinah's mum what's been going on, she says to the two brothers, to Harvey and Lloyd, you know, you're lying, you're making this up, you just got in trouble for bad behaviour, that's what the school told me. And, you know, this is entirely plausible. And I think it speaks to that terrible power disparity, which you feel quite keenly as a child, between yourself and, if not so much necessarily individual teachers, just the school as an institution, and between children and adults. And that fear that things might happen to you or might be done to you, and you might not be believed.
Yeah, definitely. And it's that, it's kind of that fear's heightened with the hypnosis, which means that they definitely won't be believed because all the other children have been hypnotized to repeat these rote phrases talking about how marvelous the headmaster is.
Should we quickly talk about my favorite thing is monsters? Briefly, because it's so good. Just before we finish, I wanted to give a mention to my favourite, it's not a children's horror, but favourite horror thing, or one of my favourite things of the year with a child protagonist, which is Emil Ferris's My Favourite Thing is Monsters, which is a remarkable graphic novel published by Fantagraphs.
It's just astonishing. It's just incredibly good.
Yeah, to the degree that only really high power can do it justice, that I do feel a bit lost for words when confronted with it, because, you know, it's a mammoth book, for one thing. I mean, you read the digital edition, didn't you, which maybe feels a little less imposing, because the actual book, you know, is huge.
Yeah, well, I mean, it felt very long, because, I mean, it is very long, but also I was reading it in the guided view, where it sort of takes you from panel to panel, sort of, to read it. although there aren't really panels.
Yeah, so it kind of
sometimes it shows you the whole page and then just zooms into bits so you can read the text.
Okay.
Stuff, but it sort of felt like this incredibly long guided tour through all these like hundreds and hundreds of drawings and little bits of text and dialogue and
I mean, the book itself almost has a feel of a scrapbook, right? So it's got clippings and it's all drawn on lined like notebook paper, so it looks almost like a child's exercise book. And as you say, it doesn't really adhere to the panel format, so it's this great sort of sprawling mass of images and ideas and annotations and some lovely, I mean, it's semi-autobiographical, and it's one of those semi-autobiographical things where you've got no idea reading it what on earth is real and what isn't, but that's sort of part of the intrigue and fun of it. But it focuses on Karen, who believes herself to be a werewolf and wears a detective's coat through a lot of the story. And she lives in the neighbourhood of Chicago in the 1960s. So growing up where Ferris grew up herself. And her upstairs neighbour, who she's very close to, is murdered. And so she decides to set off on an investigation. And it's made up of recollections and drawings by her brother Dee's. And reflections, and also presumably Karen's drawings of the front covers of various horror magazines.
And also like lots of renditions of various artworks, because they go to visit the art gallery several times throughout the course of the story.
And the technical chops on display really.
just astonishingly good drawing.
So there was an article in The Guardian with sadly very few comments, and one of the comments was very sort of dismissive. Oh, you know, the art doesn't look like anything special. I was like, what? Come on.
You what, mate?
that's pretty much my response. Like, yeah, it's just say absolutely, and really, it's really warm, it's intimate, it's provocative, deeply intelligent, but kind of pulls all this off with a real lightness of touch. Like, it doesn't feel like reading some big, heavy, important novel. It's fun, even while it deals with very dark themes.
And I definitely I definitely relate to idea of, well, I think the author said in an interview that, you know, she, when she was growing up, like, she didn't want to be a girl, like, she didn't want to be a boy either, but she just didn't want all the things that came with being a girl or being a woman, you know, just wanted to be a monster. which I relate to in a non-binary way, sort of.
Yeah, I think the potential for the monster identity as an exciting and creative thing rather than just a horrible bad thing is really kind of usefully explored.
Yeah, and it's and Karen is sort of realizing that she's queer as well, so it's definitely that association of being queer and being an outsider and being a monster, and but being a monster in a good way.
Yeah, it's really, really amazing. So I'd recommend it to anyone, basically. And if you find it too cost prohibitive, It's slightly less expensive digitally, or ask your library to get a copy, because, you know, every library should have this one. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Right, well, I think our next episode is going to be, well, on the Goosebumps. Obviously not all the Goosebumps. We're just going to be
starting our epic journey into the Goosebumps.
So, obviously, this is going to be an occasional thing we dip our toes into, because there is a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
How many of them are written by R.L. Stine? It's hard to say, but I think the ones we're looking at do have the classic R.L. Stine feel to them, I reckon.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
Happy keep it spooky.
Yeah, happy 2017, creepy kids.
Try not to be too scared by your boilers. I'll see you next time.